Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in the space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Good afternoon, everyone, from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the May 1st, 2010 edition of Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, happy May Day to everyone out there. There's plenty to celebrate today here along the Space Coast and really throughout the state of Florida, thanks to some really good news coming from Tallahassee this week, the good news that continued right up until yesterday. We're going to talk a little bit about that in just mere moments. And then later in the program, we invite you to stick around as the hardest working man in space show business, Miles O'Brien, will be with us to talk shop for the rest of the hour. And we'd like to have you join in with us as well. As always, give us a call at 321-768-1240 from anywhere you are. Local AT&T wireless customers can punch in *1240 for a free telephone call. And if you happen to be listening online at WMMBAM.com, send us an email to spacetalking@AOL.com. Okay, huge news out of Tallahassee this week. Couldn't be more thrilled. Everyone in the state of Florida who supports the space program should be just as happy. And to hear to help me revel in the moment is the president of Space Florida, our good friend Frank DiBello. Frank joins us from the roads of Brevard County, I believe.
That is true, Jim. How are you?
Good. How are you today, sir?
Fine, thank you.
Well,
let me start, if I may, just by complimenting you on the program, Space Talk. I think you're doing a real great service for the industry, and I appreciate the quality of what you do.
Well, Frank, appreciate that. And let's get to the good news. $31 million plus the headline appropriated for a variety of efforts that is going to help our state, I guess, compete locally and nationally and for worldly for space business. You must feel like a kid in a candy store that just got his allowance.
Well, I have to say, all along during this session, I've been really pleased with the support we've gotten out of the governor's office, from the governor and lieutenant governor on down through the legislature. I'm especially grateful to Senators Mike Haradopoulos and Dot Altman, as well as Representative Steve Crisafulli and Rich Workman, and the whole variety, both sides of the aisle. It's really been bipartisan support for space as an industry that's critical to the economic well-being of the state, and they have been nothing short of phenomenal.
Well, and I think the numbers, you know, which are great, we'll talk about in a minute, but that's really the other big story here, is that you've got the entire Brevard delegation working together. You've got people around the state of Florida, our lawmakers, who I think are finally getting it, that space is important for the entire state.
Well, and that's the thing that really has been. It's been widespread support across the state. It's not just been a Brevard issue in any sense of the term. They all see the power of space as a catalyst for innovation across the state,
yeah,
and are very, very supportive. Space was given a what I call class one status this year in the state, and it really showed in the results in the last days of session.
Now, Frank, we don't have time to go over every element and every line item here, but give us the highlights. You've got all this money appropriated. It looks like the vast majority of it is basically under the care of you and your organization. What is this going to allow us to do here in the next year?
Well, it maintains our budget for sure at roughly $3.8 million, which is a lot of the money we need for housekeeping and support of the infrastructure that we've got. But we're also given another $7.5 million for new infrastructure, and allows us to start a long-awaited work on Exploration Park as well as some other needed items. For the first time, we've been given a $10 million infusion of funds into a space business investment and what we're calling a financial services trust fund. And this allows us to facilitate a number of financings for large infrastructure that will, in fact, bring jobs to the state. There's $3 million of non-recurring general revenue for targeted business development support, which is basically our project money.
Okay.
This is funding that we have not had in the last few years, and it has greatly hindered the ability of the agency to help small businesses that come to us with oftentimes very interesting business plans, but we just haven't had the money to support them. There's $3.2 million that is targeted directly for the retraining of workers and keeping that core workforce that we have here in the state focused on new job opportunities.
Frank, do we know anything more about that in more detail? I know you had the big summit yesterday, very busy talking about new plans for workers. When we talk about retraining workers and that money, what does that go toward?
Well, it generally is best used when you've got a jobs base that you can target workers toward. So workforce training in itself doesn't do you a lot of good unless you've got the other end of the equation, which are the jobs. So the job creation aspects are critically important as well, and that's why the economic development work that the EDC of the Florida Space Coast has been doing, as well as what the Workforce Board has been doing, really are, they've been great partners with us in creating a new business environment. We have a number of target opportunities, some existing today and some on the horizon, which require certain kinds of skills, and we've got a lot of really talented workers in our workforce. We want to keep the core of those that are required for our next generation of space activity, but really help those that may not have such an easy time transitioning to that new work with the kind of training that gets their skills for new industry applications.
Now, you mentioned some of the money and being infrastructure, and I don't know exactly what that word means in this context. Are we building launch pads? Are we building processing facilities, operational laboratories?
Well, it may be all of the above. It's whatever that it will take to help position the state to win or secure key roles in support of the International Space Station as a national lab, to attract additional launches here. So we will probably be doing some infrastructure work on Launch Complex 46 because we've got some near-term launch companies and customers that want to fly from there. So my goal is to increase the number of launches but also increase the kind of support that we can give to people who are flying on top of these vehicles. So it's the next generation spacecraft providers, the commercial cargo and crew providers. We've got a significant base coming.
And none of this happens overnight. You get this money, the fiscal year starts, what, July 1st? You know, when do we start seeing some action based on the cash infusion?
Well, I think you're going to see, as we deploy this capital, you'll see results in this year for sure, and it'll be ramping up. Over time, nothing, as an example, when somebody's going to hire 300 or 400 people, they rarely hire 300 or 400 on day one.
Right.
So I expect we'll begin to see the activity in this fiscal year and ramping up over the next year or so.
Go ahead. I was going to say, in terms of your staff and your ability to execute all of this, will Space Florida need to grow?
I don't expect to grow a larger staff. That's not what it's about. I'd rather work in collaboration and partnership with other organizations in the state that exist and have talents that we can leverage and use.
Right.
I'd rather take down any walls that are there and work collaboratively with the myriad of capabilities we have in the state. We may need some additional talent in certain areas, but I'm not looking for a larger organization, but I am looking for a lot more effectiveness in what we do.
And Frank, just one last question with about 30 seconds. What happens next, in terms of next year? This is a one-year deal. Can we expect this kind of support in future years? Do we need this kind of support?
Well, let me comment that the legislature has been supportive all along, and I think they've recognized the industry for the value that it has to the state. I expect to see that support continue. I don't know that it'll be the same level of financial support each year, but what we're going to really focus our attention on are the kinds of incentives and other mechanisms that create a better business environment for doing space business in the state. We are going to really enhance and differentiate ourselves from the other states and make this the place to be if you want to do space business.
Frank, thanks a lot. We're out of time. And when we come back, we're going to be talking with Miles O'Brien. This is Space Talk. I'm Jim Behnke, and you're listening to WMMB.
And now back to Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back to Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Banky. 321-768-1240 is the number to call to join me today with your questions or comments. If you're listening live online right now at WMMBAM.com, send us an email to spacetalking@AOL.com. Well, when I was growing up in Minnesota and watched the launch and mission coverage of Apollo on television, I got my information from men like Walter Cronkite and Jules Bergman and Frank McGee and even Jay Barbary, although don't tell him I ever admitted to that publicly, should you see him around town. In more modern times, though, the Space Shuttle Generation, the go-to television journalist has been Miles O'Brien, formerly of CNN. Miles is working independently now, and from his online launch coverage and weekly video reports for spaceflightnow.com to the many different organizations he's consulting with and working with, including serving on NASA's advisory council, he is without a doubt the hardest working man in space show business, and he is joining us on the phone today from New York, a true space cadet, my longtime colleague. Miles, welcome to Space Talk.
Hey, Jim, thank you so much. What a great introduction. I don't feel like I belong in that company, but, you know, sort of in some respects, I'm the last man standing, I guess.
Well,
but I appreciate it.
It has been that way in the industry, and that's a topic for another day for sure as things change. But let's talk about your perspective on things here. Now, you know, you have this front row seat as a journalist. You have some kind of some of the behind the scenes views, if you will, of being on the advisory council, and going back to February with the budget coming out and the change in direction that we saw. What was your reaction to all of that? What was your personal reaction, and maybe after that describe what you felt, how you reacted to the reaction?
Yeah, well, that's a big question. You know, my overall sense of the situation right now is I'm very sad for the state that the program that is in. And this is not the fault of the current administration as much as it is the fault of years and years of kicking this can down the road.
Yeah.
We've known for a long time that the shuttle was not going to fly forever, and we haven't as a nation planned ahead. And so whatever you say about what we fly next into space, this gap, this period of time where we're not flying, is something that was completely preventable if we had just spent a little bit of effort thinking about it and planning for it ahead and a little bit of extra money. You know, the truth is, you know, everybody says, oh, NASA is a waste of money. It's a half a penny on your dollar of taxes spent, a half a penny. We spend about that amount of money collectively on coffee every year.
Right.
And so, you know, people say, oh, we can't afford NASA. So well, here we are in this situation where we didn't make the investments in a timely way. We're left with this horrendous gap, which could become a chasm, and there's a lot of uncertainty about what we're going to fly next. That's the downside. The upside is, I would say probably 90% of what the Obama administration has rolled out in that budget is very exciting. The notion of finally unleashing our wonderful private sector, the free market, the things that America does best in low Earth orbit, is a very exciting prospect to me. You know, the irony is not lost on me and many others that the Russians are better capitalists in space than we are.
And have been
we
for
need
years.
To fix that.
Yeah.
Exactly. We need to have a Silicon Valley approach to low Earth orbit. It's probably no coincidence that a lot of Silicon Valley money is funding that mm-hmm. very notion. I think it's great that we're funding aeronautics in a proper way. Earth Sciences gets a boost.
Right.
Folks at JPL are tap dancing because of the robotic missions. And then we're left with this whole issue of what we should do about human beings in space. And that's where it gets a little dicier, and we can talk a little more about that.
Well,
I'm pretty ambivalent right now, as you can gather.
But is it, you know, this is the part of the whole thing that bothers me is that I think the pieces are still there. We're still talking about going to Mars. We're still talking about leaving low Earth orbit. Now, we've argued since the vision came out in 2004 what the best way to go to Mars is. Constellation said, let's go to the moon. Others were saying, we've been there, done that. Let's go do asteroids, or let's go to the moons of Mars first, or whatever. But we're still heading in the direction. I think the idea of developing some of this technology that we're talking about, in-orbit refueling, tremendous commercial applications for in-orbit refueling, going up and refueling all those satellites at geosynchronous. You know how much money can be saved and how much money can be made in doing that? But we got to get the cost to low Earth orbit down. And I think all those pieces are there. But, and here we are, you and me in the communications business, has it been packaged properly? Is the vision been set out there in such a way that the people can grasp it, grab hold of it, and get excited about it?
Well, it's a combination of things. You know, for one thing, what is being announced is, in fact, a sea change. And to announce a sea change, to roll out to the public something as significant as this, as big a change as this, in a budget document, is a communications no-no in a big way.
Oh, yeah.
There were no words that were attached to it on February 1st when that budget rolled out. And as a result, it was characterized in ways that, frankly, weren't accurate. And so now, you know, the president comes to Florida finally after weeks and weeks of talk and criticism from the space community about it. And frankly, you know, let's face it, the space business is run by a few key members of Congress who are, frankly, interested in jobs for their constituents more than the exploration of space. There's no question in my mind that's what their interest is.
Right.
Yeah, Richard Shelby is about bringing bacon home to Alabama, and he admits it. So you've got a combination of not explaining it, not connecting the dots at the outset, coupled with old-fashioned bare-knuckle, pork-barrel politics saying, you know, don't take my jobs away.
Right.
It's a bad combination. The president put some good words on it, but, you know, it was a little late in the game, frankly. He was busy with health care, I understand. But there we are. Now we're in this mired in this debate, which is just in so many ways nonsensical at this point. Because, you know, Obama's getting blamed for the shuttle going away. Well, that wasn't his decision. The fact that the Ares Constellation program was underfunded, delayed, and wasn't going to get us anywhere in any timely way. I mean, Ares 1, the way it was set up, Ares 1 was going to be on the scene after the space station was supposed to be deep sixed.
Right.
And that, let's not forget that. The Constellation program, as it was, required that the space station be deep sixed in 2015. That's a mind-boggling prospect after 25 years and $160 billion. To think about deep-sixing it before we ever had an opportunity to see what kind of scientific endeavor was going on in there. So, you know, there's a lot of things that weren't said in a timely way, and unfortunately now you've got people are entrenched in their political positions.
So now here you are, Miles, and you're in a position. You're sitting on the NASA Advisory Council as sort of the PR guy, if you will. You know, what are you advising? What do we need to help you to advise NASA to do?
Well, you know, we need to explain it and keep explaining it and make it clear to people what is happening. It's a difficult thing because we are all, we grew up, we are children of Apollo, and our view of success in space is let's get somewhere by the end of the decade,
right,
whatever the case may be.
Right.
And, you know, it's interesting because I think the way to explain it to people is, you know, when Eisenhower announced the interstate system, that was not nearly as exciting as GM rolling out a brand new Corvette, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody gets excited about the Corvette, but the Corvette's not going anywhere without the interstate.
Right.
Well, we can say now that Eisenhower, in laying the groundwork for that infrastructure we know as the interstates, made it possible for Corvettes and Lexuses and Mercedes to do very well in this country.
That's right.
What Obama is laying out is the beginnings of a space infrastructure, that space interstate, if you will, or that interplanetary highway, if you will. And it's not as sexy. It's harder for people to get a notion on it because it's not that cool Corvette that's going to take you down the road real fast. So I think if we start explaining to people, we're not about a sprint anymore. We're not about flags and footprints. We are about being a viable, sustainable presence in space. So that means, number one, let's get out of low Earth orbit for the government. Let's make that a business. That's fantastic. Maybe we all get to go if that business does well. Let's hope it does. And then let's say to NASA, what is it going to take for us to become a true spacefaring planet? I don't mean nation. You know, one of the key things I think of the big mistakes of the Constellation program was that it was a go-it-alone plan.
Mm-hmm.
You look at that International Space Station, it is alive and well today, guaranteed because it was a partnership with 16 nations. Had it been a go-alone plan, it would have been canceled in the mid-90s because instead we had these obligations to Russia, the Europeans, to the Japanese, to the Canadians, and it became impossible to kill because it was a multinational effort. It is obvious to me that anything we do deeper in space should be built on that partnership. I mean, that is probably the singular best accomplishment of the International Space Station, is that we have 16 nations who have figured out how to work together in an incredibly detailed, granular way, and it works. Why not build on that partnership? And then you're going to create missions which are a lot harder for people to cancel.
Absolutely agree with that. And in fact, with the nations being involved, it's a lot harder to quit when you got other people counting on you, you know, as opposed to doing it all by yourself. Miles, we're going to just take a quick break here. This is our bottom of the hour, five-minute built-in hold is what we like to call it. We're going to take a break for news, weather, and sports. And when we come back from our break, we'll have more with Miles O'Brien. We'll talk about more about the space program and NASA's future, hopefully with your participation at 321-768-1240. But in the meantime, take a little break here and get caught up on everything. And we'll be back with more with Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Banky, and you are listening to WMMB.
With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Banky.
And welcome back to this second half of Space Talk on WMMB, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. 321-768-1240 is the number to call to join me and my guest today, Miles O'Brien, on the phone with us from New York. The one and only is, again, the hardest working man in space show business today. Send us some email to spacetalking@AOL.com. And throughout the week, if you want to stay in touch with us, our Twitter account is spacetalking. You can follow us that way, or you can certainly go to WMMBAM.com, enter the keyword spacetalk, and you'll see our show webpage there as well. So we invite you to stay in touch with us throughout the week as the space news continues. Miles, let's talk some more here. Again, thanks for being here and taking time to chat with us.
It's a real pleasure to be with you today. Thank you for inviting me.
You bet. I do have an email. Okay, so this is the moment of controversy, okay? I told you this would be all very
all
conversational
right.
fun, but here's your moment of controversy. We have an email from an old-timer, he signs it, in Cocoa Beach. And and basically, okay, I'm not going to read this verbatim. Basically what he's saying is he loves your coverage on spaceflightnow.com, loves the long-winded stuff beforehand, and how you guys fill those 3 hours, I don't know. But when that launches, and you light up the cigars, he gets angry. Because
he doesn't like that.
He doesn't like that because the tradition in the space program has always been you don't light up until the guys are safely back down on the ground.
Well, actually, there's a tradition that it does allow for a cigar to be lit in outside the launch control room, and I don't know what part of NASA he worked for, but just so you know, the tradition is this, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I've talked to the people who are involved in this tradition, so I don't think I'm off base on this one. When they, on launch day, and every day, as a matter of fact, there is a contingency schedule that allows them to march through a timeline for a 24-hour scrub turnaround.
Right.
Every day they go to the launch pad, they just have that in their hip pocket in case they do, in fact, have to do that. So they don't have to think about what to do next to get the thing turned around for the next day. And when they have a successful launch, once they get to MECO, and they've had a successful launch, the members of the team, launch team, as well as members who are in charge of the flow directors, the people who actually prepare the orbiter and the shuttle stack for flight, light up cigars by lighting and burning that 24-hour scrub schedule. So that is the tradition. And yes, there is an opportunity and a desire to celebrate a safe landing, but getting to MECO and getting to space and not having to do that 24-hour scrub is a moment to savor as well.
And I've heard of that same tradition, Miles, and totally back you up on that. The other big tradition, of course, here at Kennedy Space Center is the eating of the beans, and that's not a tradition that's ever made its way over to the press site. I don't know if that's on purpose or not. We all have our own traditions, but have you ever had the beans, by the way? Have you ever had a chance to do that?
I did get a chance to do that one time. I did have the beans, and you know, I would do the beans, except it requires me to cook, and we're not well catered at Space Flight now. It's a lot easier for me to stash a couple stogies and just do it that way. But the beans are a good tradition as well. You know, of course, at Jet Propulsion Lab, they have this tradition of peanuts, salted peanuts.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if you know that one. Yeah. Whenever there is a entry, descent, and landing phase of a spacecraft, they all have salted peanuts at the consoles, all because years ago there was one of their program directors or program scientists, program engineers, was partial to them, and then they had a successful landing. It might have gone back to Viking or even before.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, these guys are rocket scientists, but there's a little bit of superstition involved. It's not quite up to Russian standards on the superstition, but
no,
it's there.
No, you're right. You're right. And, of course, the Russians allow priests at the pad to dunk you in water and all that and getting out and relieving yourself on the tire of the van on the way to the pad is always a good one. But
Because Yuri did.
What more reason do you want than that, you know? So lots of fun stuff there. And that is the fun stuff about this space program that I wish more people knew. You know, now the engineering's important, the destinations and all that, but you know, it's those kinds of stories. And I guarantee you, Miles, I'll get some email after the program that says this was the best part of the show just now. You know, we can talk about all the politics and all that, but it's this stuff that humanizes it that makes it possible for people to connect with what we're doing.
Yeah, and this is such a huge issue with me, and it was an issue with me in my role as a reporter, and now that I'm the NASA Advisory Council, is, you know, giving NASA permission to make offer up the human dimension a little bit more. You know, for example, I forget the name of the card game. There's a card game that the commander of every shuttle mission must play before he is allowed to leave the suit-up room at the operations and checkout building. He has to lose.
Right.
He has to lose the game with the suit techs there. And until he loses a hand, he cannot leave. You know, little thing like that. People love that stuff. And it's stuff that, for whatever reason over the years, NASA has built up barriers between the public and that granularity and that humanity of the whole thing. And it becomes a little bit banal, frankly. And so I think that's unfortunate.
And this is a direction that I didn't think we'd go, but, you know, I worry a little bit about the commercial guys, too, because now they don't have to, you know, they're not the government required to be open kind of thing. They're private business. They can do whatever they want. But again,
you've hit on a hot button for me. We were just discussing this at our NASA Advisory Council meeting. As a matter of fact, the recommendation which I am working on, and I have to consult with the commercial committee of the NAC. But the bottom line is they are a private entity, and it is a different contracting process, and it is no longer cost plus. But there's a lot of taxpayer money in the game there. And we have to come up with a way to ensure that the public has access and visibility to these tests that Elon Musk and the likes are going to conduct. And so we got to work on that. Though I don't know what is in the specifics that is in those contracts, but you know, I would think if I were in SpaceX, I would want to have the support of NASA Public Affairs and be able to broadcast on NASA TV what's going on out there. The hot fire test of SpaceX was not good in that respect. We did not have access. Elon Musk ended up giving up a fairly detailed statement, but it was at least 24 hours after the event, which in this day and age, as you know, puts it in the category of ancient history.
Right. Right, absolutely. And in fact, when commercial launches first started here from the Cape, going back to the Boeing and the Lockheed and the McDonnell Douglas days, with Delta II and the earliest Atlas II, we had to basically say here locally as reporters that you're launching off a government range, and because of that, we have to have access, and the public has to know for safety reasons when this thing is going to fly and what's going on while it's flying. And there were some give and take, but by and large, you know, very cooperative. And then they soon realized how much the benefit it was to get that publicity, to turn it into a big event so that everyone could see what was going on, because the delays and the launches, we're used to that around here. It's not any big deal. So,
well, you know, it's funny. I had the good fortune. I'm not bragging, but I had the good fortune to work with Walter Cronkite, as you know. And one of the stories he told me was, you know, back in those days before you guys had hammered out that kind of relationship, in the very early, this would have been early NASA days, and the military was still futzing around with all its tests, they were all, there was no public disclosure on anything. And so what they would do is they would station a cameraman, film cameras, at the jetty there.
Right.
And they did them all at night because it was easier to make them secret. And so they wait up and they wait and look for lit gantries. And they would have to sit there with their finger on the trigger waiting for something to happen, you know, because you can't rely on the sound because the sound comes much after the flame. And so it turns out that Henry Landworth, the famous owner of the Holiday Inn there,
right.
Coco, which became the watering hole, what would happen was if they had a scrub, they would release a fair number of the personnel, and they'd all come into the Holiday Inn to have a couple of drinks. And so Henry Landworth would send a runner out to the film guys and say, hey, they're all in drinking. I think there's a scrub. And
no,
they could come in.
No,
but that was the only way they knew.
That's right.
So I feel like we're kind of back to that in a sense.
Well, you know, and let me expand on that story really quickly because – then it was not soon after that that the media were able to get one of the generals to agree that there would be a briefing as to what launches were to take place, but you could not report on that until you had seen fire in the flame trench. And once you saw fire in the flame trench, you were released to go ahead and talk about that launch. And that is why, to this day, we're so antsy about being able to make sure our cameras can see the rockets on the pad. We don't want to wait for it to get above the tree line. We need to see the thing on the pad. Now, some of these guys don't realize that's why, but that's why it has always been that way, is because we have to see the rocket on the pad to confirm what we're seeing with our own eyes. And
I mean, you can imagine the wire service guy on the phone to, you know, New York or whatever and saying, I got fire in the hole. Release it right now. You know, great stuff.
Fire in the flame trench, you know. So anyway. Well, gee, we just spent almost our whole segment here. Let me ask you really quick, though. Give us a minute here really quick on your background and why you turned into the aviation and space guy that you did. What's about this thing that appeals to you in about 45 seconds?
Well, you know, I love things that fly. I was fascinated by Apollo. I grew up loving every aspect of it. Didn't necessarily want to become an astronaut for whatever reason. I didn't get great scientific education, I guess, along the way. And so I ended up doing communications history, had a love for that as well. Out of the blue, in 1992, I heard that CNN was seeking a science correspondent. I was a private pilot, but I didn't really have any science background. I was a history major, but I managed to convince CNN that what they needed was a history major who actually wasn't afraid of the subject matter. And I thought that was kind of a line, but it's actually true.
Yeah.
And, of course, that put me right in the realm with NASA. I worked many years with John Holloman, of course, the late, great John Holloman.
Absolutely.
As his second. And then ultimately found myself as a space correspondent, and I've loved every minute.
It's been an incredible ride with your career. And we're going to take our final quick break. Miles, stick around with us for one more segment here. When we return, more with Miles O'Brien. And this is Space Talk, by the way, brought to you by United Space Alliance. I am Jim Behnke, and you're listening to WMMB.
This is Space Talk with Jim Behnke.
And welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's Space Talk, sponsored by United Space Alliance. My special guest from New York, Miles O'Brien. Miles O'Brien, who is, by the way, multitasking as we speak. I see him posting to Twitter and to Facebook and the like. Before we continue and finish up today with Miles, I want to remind everybody that Brevard Community College will feature a panel discussion called Space, What's in It for Me? On Friday, May 14th at 7 p.m. in the Coco Campus Planetarium and Observatory. The panel includes Space Florida President Frank DiBello, NASA KSC's Director of Engineering Patrick Simpkins, National Space Policy Expert James Muncy, and me, Jim Behnke. The panel will be moderated by Space Florida's Director of Education, Tony Gannon. Afterwards, tour the observatory and watch the stars through telescopes, compliments of the Brevard Astronomical Society. The event is free and open to the public. And for more information about the BCC Space and Astronomy Lecture Series, call 321-433-7653. That's 321-433-7653. Space, What's in It for Me? The panel discussion in May. Miles O'Brien, if you were to be standing up at that panel session, what would be the top one or two things you'd list as what's in it for space?
Well, you know, space to me, you know, aside from that desire that I think all human beings have to continue exploring. And when we stop exploring, we lose something that is fundamental to being a human being. But space, as a more practical way to bring it home to people, is about making our country competitive on a global platform. What is it that we have forgotten that the Chinese and the Indians think is so important? Why is it that India, where the per capita average income is about $800 a year, why is it they think it's important enough to have a space program and send human beings into space? What is it that we are taking for granted here, I often ask myself. The truth is, a vibrant space program does so many things that that are difficult to accrue to the bottom line in inspiring our kids, making them want to take science and other technological, engineering, mathematics programs. And keeping our American kids in that game is crucial to what happens to this country in the future. The Apollo moon race is, you could make a very strong argument, it laid the groundwork for Silicon Valley, not just in the technical components that it yielded, but mm-hmm. in inspiring a whole group of young kids to take these courses and ultimately become computer programmers and ultimately create a tremendous force for economic opportunity. So I see it as something that is crucial to what a great nation does and how a great nation will stay great.
Now, how are we going to get there from here to here, from there to here? I look at this sea change in the space program, and I say to myself, okay, I agree. I'm not necessarily anymore for destinations and deadlines. The Kennedy speech was great. It motivated us. We got to the moon, and then the nation forgot it because the goal was done. And I don't want to design one car to get me from here to Minnesota and back in the middle of the winter. I want to design something that I can go anywhere, anytime. I want a Millennium Falcon. Okay, I don't need a specific rocket to go to a specific place. I think this technology development, I think this budget, this policy is going to help us go in that direction. But it doesn't have a pretty bow on it. I've been saying locally here, Miles, that I want a patch. I want a patch with a name on it. I want something I can rally around, a symbol. But it doesn't have to be a destination by a certain deadline. It can be a vision for an opportunity to expand into the solar system. Can we create that?
Yes, we can. You know, here's the thing. Here's the thing that we have to – I was just in Houston. I just got back from Houston, and I was there for the NASA Advisory Council meeting as well as the RNASA, the big space prom down there. And we had an opportunity to tour through the Johnson Space Center. And I almost didn't go because I feel like, oh, I've been there. I know Building 9. I know the simulators and all that stuff. They showed us some remarkable things that they are doing, including some robotics technology, some humanoid robotics technology, which is mind-blowing. You know, when you think about humanoid robotics, you know, things that are on two legs and have fingers and all that sort of thing, you think of the Japanese because they do a great job marketing it. We're about 10 years ahead of the Japanese right there at the Johnson Space Center. Now, what this means is people do not understand that NASA is doing those kinds of things. So this is a communication challenge as much as anything. We've had the shuttle program, and to the extent that the shuttle program has been there, it's sort of taken all the oxygen out of the room. It has past the public affairs people, the reporters are in the cycle of covering the missions, and in a sense, we've all gotten kind of lazy about reporting about NASA.
Yeah.
There's a lot underneath the hood there that we're not telling people about, and we need to get busy on the NASA side pushing it out, and as reporters, we owe it to people to tell the story of how their taxpaying money is being spent. There's remarkable things going on in every one of those 10 centers that no one knows about.
And
if we can get that out there, that's the patch. The patch is innovation is born here.
Yeah, I so agree with that. And I do some work with NASA Aeronautics, and there's so much good stuff happening on the aviation side that it screams to me. I said, I wish I'd known this 20 years ago as a reporter to spend some time on this. It's so fascinating to see what NASA's doing, and it's good news. It's good stuff, and sometimes I think my fellow space reporters today just are missing the beat in the day-to-day grind of pumping everything out and beating the next guy and finding the next little thing to talk about. It just drives me absolutely crazy.
Well, you know, it's a lot, frankly, it's a lot cheaper to park a reporter down there at the Kennedy Space Center and have them go to briefings, right?
Yeah.
And to actually get out there and get into the centers and get under the hood requires some effort. And, you know, NASA needs to meet reporters halfway on this and do a better job of getting the word out. But the truth is there's tremendous interesting things going on, And I think it's, you know, it's high time that we got that story out there. It's actually very exciting. And, you know, you talk about aeronautics. You know, I've talked to pilots who don't even understand that this new FAA next-gen system, this satellite-based system, is really all built on NASA technology,
which comes out of
Langley and Ames.
Yeah.
And no one knows that. Why not? Everybody says, why do we need NASA? That's the answer.
That's absolutely the answer. Miles, we're going to wrap it up here. Thank you so much for that. We're going to talk more with you again. There's absolutely no doubt. I want to remind everyone quickly that next week on Space Talk, a pair of true steely-eyed missile men will join me in the studio to talk about the Delta rocket program, which this month is celebrating its 50th anniversary of launch operations. The rocket has quite a history, an important legacy. We'll be talking with the legendary figures of Lyle Holloway and John Nealon. And also remind you that the Falcon 9 launch, no earlier than May 11th, probably slipping to the end of the May as the Air Force and Elon Musk and SpaceX folks continue to work out some paperwork issues with range safety. Increasingly certain to be the final flight of Shuttle Atlantis remains set for launch May 14th at 2:19 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time in the afternoon. And be sure to remind you all to stay tuned to our coverage on that at MMB at the launch time. Of course, Miles O'Brien will be on spaceflightnow.com with his full launch coverage in the hours preceding. Well, that's it for today. Thank you for listening so much. Space Talk is sponsored by United Space Alliance and is a production of Mylas Solutions. Aaron Michaels is this Starship's chief engineer. I'm Jim Banky, and we'll talk to you again real soon. Now, don't go anywhere. Dan Connery is next as Live and Local Radio continues on a Saturday afternoon right here on WMMB.